Welcome to According to Sam, folks. Thank you guys for watching. This is episode 183. And I hope you guys had a great weekend. I hope you had a good Monday. And we're going to pick up where we left off in the last podcast. I was debating about starting this podcast, talking about the border, the migration issue, which I'm going to save a little time at the end of this podcast to get into that topic, to get started talking about that topic. And then we're going to talk about that topic more probably for the entire podcast on Friday. There is a Senate bill now that has been released to the public. The Senate hasn't voted on it yet, but probably by Friday, they will have voted on it. They want to move it through the Senate and get into the House ASAP. And so we're going to talk about that bill. We're going to talk about the larger migration, immigration, invasion, whatever you want to call it. But to start the podcast today, I want to pick up where I left off in the last podcast because I left a lot on the table and it's stuff that really needs to be addressed. And we were talking about the Sumerian people. We were talking about their culture. We were talking about their writing system, the cuneiform writing system that they created. And we were explaining the caste system in the Sumerian society. And we explained that the later Sumerian society had a caste system that looks like what is on the screen there. The earlier caste system we talked about in the last podcast, the priest was on top. There were no kings, and the priest was on the top of the caste. And then you had a council of nobles. You had a lower council of commoners, and it was a democratic system that you voted for the council of commoners, the council of nobles. You had a middle class, a lower class, and then the priest was at the top of the caste. And then we explained how the kings first came about in Sumerian society after 1,000 years of the priest being the highest authority in their society. Then the king comes along and he begins to be the highest authority. And sometimes the king and the priest is the same person. Sometimes the king and the priest, they work together to balance their power up here. And we ended last podcast talking about the fact that it would have been advantageous for the kings and the priests and the nobles in the higher classes, in the higher castes, to have a educated and literate lower class. Like, they weren't teaching cuneiform to slaves and commoners and even merchants and artisans. There was no need for them to learn cuneiform. It would have been very beneficial for the scribes, the priests, and the kings, the upper and higher classes, to keep the lower classes ignorant. And I finished last podcast playing the clip of what's the comedian's name, George Carlin, saying that the owners, talking about today, George Carlin was talking about today in our society, but what he was saying is very much what the structure of Sumerian society was, is that the people at the top do not want a well-educated, well-informed, literate lower class. Those type of people would be ungovernable. It is easier to govern people that are zombies. hence why you have the zombie apocalypse going on right now in our society. So I want to pick up where we were talking about that. And the premise of the beginning of the podcast today, I want to pick up on that premise and ask, you know, is there a dumbing down of the population here in the United States of America? Not only in the United States of America and Western culture, has there been a dumbing down, a strategic dumbing down of our population because dumb people are easier to govern? So that's the question that I want to ask. And to ask that question, I want to start talking about a period of time in Europe, in a place in Europe, Italy, Tuscany to be exact, a period of time where the elite in the society, and we're talking about the society in Tuscany, in Florence, in the 15th century, having the adverse opinion that I believe that the elites have today, having the adverse opinion about educating society than even the Sumerians had, that the elites in the Tuscany region of Italy in the 15th century, they believed that it was very important to educate the entire society there in Florence. And this was taken up by some humanist thinkers. And this is how the Italian Renaissance came about. This is how the Italian Renaissance started. Let's listen or read a little bit of this Wikipedia page about the Italian Renaissance. It says the Italian Renaissance was a period in Italian history covering the 15th and 16th century. Is a period known for the initial development of the broader Renaissance culture that spread across Western Europe and marked the transition from the Middle Ages to modernity. Proponents of a long Renaissance argue that it started around the 13th century and lasted until the 1600s. Renaissance argue that it started around 1300 and lasted until 1600. So it would have been the 17th century. In some fields of proto-Renaissance beginning around 1250. You're going to see here in a moment that the Renaissance began after the Black Death, after the plague, and the plague is what set off the Renaissance. I don't agree with anyone who believes that the Renaissance started before the Black Plague. And the Black Plague, I have it here, started in between 1346 and 1353. So that's the middle part of the 14th century is when the plague is over. Read a little bit about the plague. The plague started here in Venice from ships coming from the east. It was the plague, they believe, was in the saliva of fleas that were on the back of mice. It says Black Death, the bubonic plague pandemic occurring in Europe from 1346 to 1353. One of the most fatal pandemics in human history, as many as 50 million people perished. Perhaps 50% of Europe's 14th century population. So, and like I said, it began in Italy, the bubonic plague, the same place, the same country as the Italian Renaissance, just a few decades later. The bubonic plague is what set off the Renaissance. read a little bit more here. The French word Renaissance, corresponding to the Rinascimento in Italian, means the rebirth. So that's what Renaissance means. It means rebirth. And so you understand why they wanted a rebirth, because they had just experienced all of this death. Like, that we were just reading 50% of Europe's population was killed by this plague in the 14th century. So the rebirth was not only a rebirth of culture, which the Renaissance was very much a rebirth of culture, but it was rebirth of their society. So the humanist teachers in Florence at this time, they wanted here, let's read a little bit more here, because I think this part is important. It means rebirth and defines the period as one of the cultural revivals and renewed interest in classical antiquity. After the centuries during what the Renaissance humanists labeled as the Dark Ages. So the humanists in Florence, they're the ones who label the Dark Ages the Dark Ages. Historians today, they don't call the Dark Ages or the Middle Ages. See, we call it the Middle Ages, not the Dark Ages, but the humanists in Florence, they called it the Dark Ages because it was nothing but it was the dominance of the Catholic Church over everything in society. The monarchies and the Catholic Church controlled this period of time that they called the Dark Ages, and then it ends with this major plague that kills off most of the population. So that's why they called what historians called the low and early Middle Ages. The humanists called it the Dark Ages, but it wasn't a dark age at all. I mean, they saw themselves and saw the knowledge that they were bringing to the society as light again, and light is the opposite of dark. Actually, light is not the opposite of dark. Darkness is the absence of light. So that's where you get Dark Ages from. But the Dark Ages are actually the Middle Ages. And historians, they classify the Middle Ages as the low or early Middle Age. And then after the Renaissance, essentially, or a little bit before the Renaissance, you had the middle to the high, the late to high Middle Ages. So the late Middle Age, which ended around 1500. From the Middle Ages, you had the modern era, and now we are postmodern, which is a lot of what the problem is that we see going on. Postmodernism is absolutely anti-intellectual. It is completely anti-intellectual, and this postmodern era is a large part of the problem that we're experiencing right now. So what is the problem that we're experiencing? First, let's go further into what the humanist teachers, this was their idea of the new birth of the society there in Florence, was to resurrect classical antiquity, is what it says here. The classics, everything about the classics. So they wanted to resurrect classical Rome, classical Greece, the philosophers like Plato, like Aristotle, like writers like Cicero, like Pliny the Younger, and going back and reading all of their stuff, and not only reading their stuff, resurrecting their ideas. And not only their ideas, but their way of thinking, their way of constructing ideas. They taught the population there in Florence logic. Logic was very important in teaching, you know, children at a very young age how to construct arguments, what a logical fallacy was, the appeal to authority, the appeal to probability, the red herring, all of these different logical fallacies they taught. They didn't teach the population in Florence what to think. They taught them how to think. And that was very important to the Italian Renaissance. From the Italian Renaissance, you also resurrected classical art, classical architecture. That was why they, you know, ended up building the dome there in Florence. If you know that story about the Medici and the dome that was built in Florence, it's the architecture that they resurrected. So everything was about the rebirth was about resurrecting the classics, but more importantly, teaching the population how to think. And it became very, very important teaching these people how to think to not only the rebirth in Italy, but the rebirth of Western culture and the birth of the modern world. They instituted a system of education that we call liberal arts. Read a little bit here. The term liberal arts for a educational curriculum dates back to classical antiquity. So this was a part of what the humanist teachers there in Florence that were leading the Italian Renaissance, part of the classical antiquity that they were resurrecting was the liberal arts education. Term liberal arts for an educational curriculum dates back to classical antiquity and in the West, but has changed its meaning considerably, mostly expanding it. The seven subjects in the ancient and medieval meaning came to be divided in the trivium, rhetoric, grammar, logic, quadrivium, astrology, and arithmetic, geometry, and music. So this is how you got the Renaissance man. People like Leonardo da Vinci and others in this period. And then right here, this became a major part of it too. The invention of the printing press. Read right here in Germany around 1440. So this is the 15th century. Renaissance starts happening in Italy in the 14th century. A few decades later, you have the Reformation kicking off with Luther in Germany. And then Gutenberg invents the movable type printing press. So all of these things were converging at the same time in Europe, all started in Italy by a mission to educate the entire population in Italy or in Florence. It expanded from Florence out from to all of Italy, from Italy throughout all of Europe, and then in Germany. And then they started challenging the church there in Germany. It kicked off the Protestant Reformation. Gutenberg, he invents the printing press for the sole purpose of printing the Bible in the German language, in the German vernacular. The Bible at that point in time was not printed in a language that the average common German could pick up and read it. And Luther thought that that was a problem. Not only Luther, in England, Tyndale and others thought the same thing. So when Gutenberg invented this this machine to print, the only thing that he invented it for was to print the Bible. And that's what it was used for mostly until the beginning of the Age of Reason, which was, you know, happening at the same time as the Protestant Reformation. People started printing pamphlets about science, about ideas about government and political philosophies. And someone would write a pamphlet, and then people would write pamphlets to challenge the pamphlet that this individual wrote. And it created this entire, you know, age of reason that created, that went from the age of reason to the Enlightenment and the modern era. As I say, it all started in Italy. It all started with the Italian Renaissance. I tell you all of that because the question still remains that I want to ask, since that time, has there been a concerted effort to dumb down the population to make them more governable? Because did the educating of Europe and bringing Europe out of the dark age intellectually, did that make them easier to govern for the kings and the nobility of Europe? Was it a positive thing for the kings in England? Let's just take England, for example. Was it a positive thing for the kings in England to have the English population educated and brought out of the Dark Ages into the Age of Reason, into the Enlightenment period? Or ask Charles I. Charles I was beheaded during the English Civil War. And from the English Civil War, you had the Glorious Revolution. You had the King of England having to give up tons of power in the document? The God, I can't believe I'm drawing blank on that. But no, no, it didn't make the English easier to govern by the monarchy to have a population that was rising up in the Age of Reason and in the Enlightenment. How did it work out in France for Louis XVI and his wife? How did it work out for England in the Americas? What I'm telling you is that you would have never had an American Revolution if you didn't have an Italian Renaissance. You understand what I'm saying? Never. You never would have had an American Revolution without an Italian Renaissance. So the question that I'm asking is, did an educated population make it easier for the monarchy and the nobility and the higher classes in England? Did it make it more easy for them to govern? No, it made it more difficult for them to govern. And that's the same thing here in the United States, that these people have figured out that it is difficult to govern well-educated people who can think critically, who understand logical fallacies, who understand rhetoric, who understand, complex ways of thinking. Those people are not easier to govern. So there has been, this is my theory, it's not only a theory, you're going to see that there's evidence to back this up, that there has been a concerted effort by the elite to dumb down the bottom caste of our society. And they've been doing it for centuries. Well, not for centuries. Let's not, I don't want to, they've been really working at it for about a century, since the early 1920s, maybe a little bit earlier than that. Individuals like John Dewey, Rockefeller, the Rockefeller Foundation, the elites have been working to take control of public education, with the intent purpose of dumbing down the population. And the effects, again, have been quite astonishing. Hold on here. Take a listen to this clip.
Do you know how many stars there are on the U.S. flag?
52.
Yes. What state is Utah in?
Michigan.
Yes. Do you know what state Utah is in?
Yo. Utah, to be honest with you, I never heard of that place ever in my life. I live under a rock.
Can you name three countries besides the USA?
I suck at history. That was like my worst subject. Can we do like science?
No, no. Any three. You know this.
A country? Oh yeah. My jeez. This is terrible. Oh my god. A country. What, besides the U.S.?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I can't.
All right, it's fine.
I can't do history, I can't.
Do you know how many dimes there are in the dollar? Make up $1.
A dime is the 10 cent or the 5 cent?
You tell me.
I don't know.
Can you name three countries besides the USA?
Damn.
Any three. You know this.
Canada? New Mexico. Right? That's good?
Yeah.
Damn, I need one more. Damn.
Yeah, so you got Canada, New Mexico, and what?
Damn. I need to go back to school.
Do you know how many states there are in total in the U.S.?
So you guys get the picture, and this guy, I've played his videos before. He does these man on the street videos, and he's got hours of this video. Most of them there are in Times Square, but I've seen Mark Dice here on the West Coast doing the same thing. It's not like the people on the West Coast are any more intelligent than the people there in New York, where this guy does most of his videos. But he's there in Times Square. Many times he's talking to people that are visiting New York City and asking them simple questions. They don't know anything. And what I'm telling you is that this dumbing down of America is concerted. There's no way they would be able to get away with the stuff that they're able to get away with right now, unless they were dumbing these people down. They're going to vote. Of course they're going to vote. When they go in and renew their driver's license, it asks them, do they want to register to vote? Of course they're going to say yes. Or if they are on, you know, welfare or some type of state programs, they're going to ask them, do you want to vote? So they're actively getting these people to vote. And these people, I mean, if you, let's just take this migration thing, and we're getting ready to get into that whole subject, but let's just take that for example. When you come to the United States as a legal immigrant and you follow our legal laws to immigrate to this country, you have to pay money, you have to get in line, but even after all of that, you have to take a citizenship test. The citizenship test that immigrants take to become legal immigrants, that become legal immigrants of this country the correct way, they have to answer questions, basic questions, like what this guy in Times Square, that he's asking citizens of the United States that are voting. Basic questions, to become a citizen in the United States, who is the first president? How many branches of government are there? What are the three branches of government, if you even know that there are three? how many members of Congress there are, how many members of the Senate there are, how many states there are, how many, stars on the flag. The same question that this guy is asking people in Times Square, that they don't know, a legal immigrant has to pass a test answering those questions before they can become citizen. Now, the guys that are coming across the border illegally, the migrants that are coming across the border, they don't have to take a test like that. They don't have to. They don't even have to speak the language to know English. They're coming into this country. They're going to be put into the schools with your kids. So is that going to increase your kids' ability to learn when more resources are going to be that are going to have to be diverted to ESOL programs, English as my second language programs in the school? There are going to be more kids in school. So your kids are not going to be able to get the attention that they need. So you're going to start saying that these migrants are going to start even increasing the failure of the public education system. And you're going to start seeing that immediately because they may be well-intentioned. They may be, here to work, but they're not here to assimilate. And you're going to start seeing those problems. I want you to listen to a little bit of this clip. This was a fantastic interview. I forget this author's name. Hold on one moment. I don't remember his name, but it'll probably come. Newman is his last name, but let's just take a little listen to this clip. And he talks about what is going on with the education system.
The guy, I mentioned him earlier, the guy who came up with this idea that government ought to educate our children was named Robert Owen. And he was a communist. Even before Karl Marx came along and wrote the Communist Manifesto, he wanted to get rid of private property. He wanted to abolish the nuclear family. And he believed so fervently in these principles, he actually bought a piece of land in Indiana and set up a communist commune. It failed in less than 2 years. And he concluded that the reason it failed was that all these people had been raised by Christian parents in a Christian society that valued family, that valued private property, that still clung to the ideals in the Bible. And so he said, how are we going to change that? Well, and this is a fascinating story. He launched and created what a whistleblower later described as a secret society modeled on the Carbonari. And we've got the primary source documents for this in the book. The whistleblower, his name was Orestes Brownson. He says he was part of this secret society. He was in charge of organizing a part of New York. And he said the immediate goals were to shift public opinion in favor of government schools. Right? This was, again, before we had public schools in America. And they wanted to get men elected to legislatures who would support the idea of a government role for education. Well, this was a very hard sell, right? Americans were incredibly well educated, primarily homeschooled, and then all the different church denominations ran their own school networks. And then, of course, we had Christian universities like Harvard, Yale, Princeton.
I mean, Abraham Lincoln was homeschooled.
Right. And almost all of our founding fathers were primarily homeschooled, right? Some of them went on to get degrees when they were 14 or 15 at Harvard or Yale or Princeton, you know, good Christian schools back then. But homeschooling was the norm at that time. That's right. Parents, older siblings, and aunts and uncles and grandparents really were teaching how to read, how to write, how to do math, the history of the world. The Bible, of course, was the primary textbook. These were incredibly well-educated people. And so this whistleblower, Orestes Brownson, he eventually became a Catholic, and he repented of this involvement with the secret society, and he wrote a book about it. And he said that the ultimate objective, this is key, the ultimate objective, he said, was to destroy Christianity, right? Even before, you know, Antonio Gramsci, we all know about cultural Marxism and so on. But long before that, the communists had already figured out that Christianity was the giant roadblock in the way of their utopia. So that's the guy who came up with the idea of government schools. The texts and essays that he wrote ended up in the hands of the dictator of Prussia. The dictator of Prussia, according to Robert Owen in his autobiography, so much approved of this idea that the government should educate children that he ordered his interior minister to set up a network of government schools, just as Robert Owen had dreamed up. Well, the founding father of America's public school system, Horace Mann, went to Prussia, studied this system, brought it to Massachusetts, got himself selected as the first ever Secretary of Education for any state, right? We had never had a Secretary of Education in any state before that, brought the Prussian system into Massachusetts. Once he finished with Massachusetts, he went around the country preaching, like, you know, like a traveling evangelist, preaching the good news of salvation by government schools. And little by little, the other states started saying, well, we'll set up a government school here. We'll get the government involved there. And then along comes John Dewey, who's almost universally recognized today as the founding father of public education. He actually went to the Soviet Union for his ideas, Alex. This is a guy who wrote multiple essays for the New Republic about how wonderful the Soviet Union was. This is the guy who designed and built the system that today is educating our children. This was 100 years ago. So incredible, right? So he teams up with the Rockefellers, the super capitalists. You got a communist who loves the Soviet Union teaming up with the Rockefeller dynasty. They had a philanthropy called the General Education Board. They gave Dewey over $3 million to set up an experimental school at the University of Chicago, graduated a bunch of kids that couldn't read, couldn't write, couldn't tell right from wrong, and couldn't do math. And they said, that will be perfect. That's the model we'll use for the whole country. He moved over to Columbia University, started at the Teachers College, brought in the Frankfurt School criminals who
they were developing literally lawless, mindless.
Everything that this guy is saying is absolutely correct. And I'm going to go into John Dewey and the part that Rockefeller played as well. But everything the guy says in this interview is correct. He's the author of this book. His name is Alex Newman, Indoctrinating Our Children to Death. And the interview that I was just playing parts of, it was phenomenal. And it fits exactly into what I am trying to tell you about the way that the Sumerian society was structured and how similar it is to our society, that it is advantageous for the people on top to keep the people on the bottom ignorant. And this is why I want you to take a listen to this guy. Some of you may have already seen this. This was a video that went viral a few weeks ago, but Yuval Harari from the WEF, the World Economic Forum. He's one of the henchmen for Klaus Schwab. But this video was going viral a few weeks ago because Yuval Harari from the World Economic Forum was saying that people do not have rights, that you have no rights. And if you cannot logically defend yourself using rhetorical tools, like the rhetorical tools that were taught to the entire society there in Florence in the 15th century by the humanists that launched the Italian Renaissance, giving them the building blocks, the tools to construct arguments to combat this type of rhetoric, you will be a slave. I mean, we're already slaves, people. Already slaves. But I want you to listen to what this guy says.
Many, maybe most legal systems are based on this idea, this belief in human rights. But human rights are just like heaven and like God. It's just a fictional story that we've invented and spread around. It may be a very nice story. It may be a very attractive story. We want to believe it. But it's just a story. It's not a reality. It is not a biological reality. Just as jellyfish and woodpeckers and ostriches have no rights.
You're no different than a jellyfish, is what this guy just said. What's the difference between you and a jellyfish? If you cannot argue against this elitism, and this elitism, this is what I'm talking about. If you cannot defend yourself against these elitists, what's to stop them from treating you like a jellyfish, people?
Just as jellyfish and woodpeckers and ostriches have no rights, Homo sapiens have no rights also. Take a human, cut him open, look inside, you find their blood, and you find the heart and lungs and kidneys, but you don't find there any rights. The only place you find rights is in the fictional stories that humans have invented and spread around. And the same thing is also true in the political field. States and nations are also, like human rights and like God and like heaven, they too are just stories. A mountain is a reality. You can see it, you can touch it, you can even smell it. But Israel or the United States, they are just stories, very powerful stories, stories we might want to believe very much, but still they are just stories.
So this is why these people are sick. These people are they're absolutely sick. This elitism that I'm talking about. And that's what this is. This is elitism. This caste system of keeping the bottom caste dumb and ignorant so you can dominate over them. And so they will be easier for you to govern and maintain your place at the top of the caste. It's evil. It's disgusting. I want to read a little bit of this clip, and then I want to start getting into a little bit of what's going on with this migration issue. And then, like I said, we'll pick it up again in the next podcast. But this was a poll from Rasmussen that came out a couple of days ago. The date on this article is January 19. It says, shocking survey reveals the reason elites are out of touch, and it isn't why you think. It says, the United States has a wealthy, partisan, elite class that's not only immune from and numb to the problems of their countrymen, but enormously confident in and willing to impose unpopular policies on them. You have no rights, is what Havari just said. You have no rights. This is a recipe for disaster. The problem is starkly illustrated in a new survey Scott Rasmussen conducted on behalf of the Committee to Unleash Prosperity, which divided respondents between elites, and this is who an elite is, people with at least one postgraduate degree earning more than $150,000, living in a zip code where the population density exceeds 10,000 per square mile, and the general public. So that's the division is between the elites and the general public. They don't go into any description of who the general public is, but they describe who the elites are, and the elites are people with at least one postgraduate degree earning more than $150,000 a year, living in a zip code where the population density exceeds 10,000 per square mile. Rasmussen also recorded the responses of a subset of elites, super elites, which he called super elites, if you will, who graduated from a few prestigious private universities, including members of the Ivy League, Duke, Stanford, Northwestern. So if you have a postgraduate degree and make $150,000, you're an elite. But if you went to Duke, Stanford, Northwestern, Yale, Harvard, Vanderbilt, you know the schools. You can name them. Any of the Jesuit schools, Georgetown. Just name them. You know the schools that they're talking about. So if you go to those schools, then you're not. So this is why you had the scandal, the college scandal of the Hollywood elite cheating to get their kids into these prestigious schools, because these prestigious schools make you super elite. So you're super elite if you go to these prestigious schools. It's near impossible to behold the results and not acknowledge their indicative of a fundamental disconnect between two Americas. It is impossible to behold the results and not acknowledge they're indicative of a fundamental disconnect between two Americas. That disconnect should be as much concern to proud aristocracies as it is to the peasantry. It should come as no surprise that between America and its upper crust, a much higher proportion of the latter, 73%, consider themselves Democrats and approve of Joe Biden's performance as president, 84%. Joe Biden's approval rating nationally is 37-38%. The elite and the super elite approve of Joe Biden by 84%. Huh? Huh? According to Rasmussen. But there are less surface level and more telling findings. The rich are indeed getting richer, say the rich. 74% of elites and 88% of super elites report that their personal finances are on the upswing. And the bulk of those who remain say they're either unsure or they're getting neither better or worse. You see the divide here in America, people? A negligible portion of respondents said that their pocketbooks are getting lighter. Negligible. Of the elite and of the super elite, a negligible proportion of respondents said that their pocketbooks are getting lighter. Compared to Americans more generally, it's hard to believe that the two groups are living in the same country. While 40% of Americans say that their financial situation is worsening, just 20% say it's improving. This seems intuitive. It stands to reason that those who are making more money would be more inclined to think well of their financial standing. But it is striking that the class disproportionately represented in the portions of influence do not feel the same very real economic pains the rest of America does. Why? Because that makes them less likely to take steps to alleviate that pain and even more likely to worsen it in pursuit of their own ideological objectives. So then it goes into how delete, well, there's not very much more. Let me just go ahead and see how much more there is. I think that's it. Okay, let's just go ahead and read the rest of this. Government control. This truth was borne out by three groups' answers to other questions. A stunning 77% of elites and 89% of super elites support the strict rationing of meat, gas, and electricity. Did you hear what I said? Let me read it again. A stunning 77% of elites and 89% of super elites support the strict, these are Biden supporters, strict rationing of meat, gas, and electricity. 72% and 81% would ban the use of gas-powered cars. These are the elites and super elites. They would ban outright, 81% of the super elite would outright ban gas cars right now. They're all driving hybrids. They're all driving Teslas. Not only hybrids, expensive hybrids, because they're doing very well, the super elite. 55% and 70% would prevent Americans from engaging in non-essential travel. 70% answered the 70% of the super elite said that they would prevent Americans from engaging in non-essential travel. You see the problem that I'm telling you about here, people. You understand what I'm talking about? Oh, and 47% and 55% of the elite and super elite believe the government affords Americans too much freedom. You have no rights. You have no rights is what this clown from the WEF said. You have no rights. 47% and 57% of elites and super elites believe the government affords Americans too much freedoms. Quote, predictably, the rest of the country would be appalled to hear what this group would do with absolute power. The percentage that would agree to any of the those measures lies between 16. They say Trump is the one. They're telling you that Trump is the one who is the dictator, that Trump wants to be the dictator, that you should be afraid of Trump. These are the people that go to the prestigious schools, the elite and the super elite would agree to any of those measures. Wait, that absolute power. Wait, predictably, the rest of the country would be appalled to hear that what this group would do with absolute power, the percentage that would agree to any of those measures lies between 16 and 25%. And they're talking about the people at the bottom caste, the measures that the elite would agree to, 16 to 25% of the bottom caste. I think that's what it said. What's perhaps most troubling of all, however, is elite's staggering surplus of self-confidence in government, a halfway decent proxy of themselves. 70% of elites, double the number of average Americans, and 89% of super elites said they would trust the government to do the right thing. These are Biden supporters, people. So you understand what I'm telling you about the problem with a caste system that is designed to keep people dumb because they're easier to govern. And it's not only the system is not only created to keep people dumb, it's also created to play on your emotions as well and to make you very emotional about everything. I have a few minutes left. Want to get into this migration issue a little bit, and then we'll get back into it more broadly on Friday. This was the documentary that I told you about in the last podcast, and this is the documentary from Muttracker. The two brothers flew down to South America. They did the same trek that the migrants do from Ecuador to Colombia, from Colombia to Panama in the Darien Gap. And then when they come out of the Darien Gap at the other end of Panama, you're going to see in this clip how the NGOs are there waiting for them to facilitate the rest of their trip. The NGOs, the non-governmental organizations, and you're going to see who these NGOs are in a moment, are facilitating all of this. And this new bill that's coming out of the Senate has a provision in the bill to give millions of dollars to these same NGOs. It is in the new Senate bill. Millions of dollars, and we'll talk about how many millions they want to give to these NGOs who are in Central America, in Panama, facilitating this migration. These NGOs know, again, that women are being raped. They know people are being robbed, mugged, murdered, and they are facilitating. Let's take a listen to a little bit of this clip. These are the two brothers by themselves. I mean, these guys did great journalistic work, put themselves in danger to document this. So they are coming out of the jungle from the Darien Gap now, and they're walking to where the staging area for all of these NGOs. And these guys that are walking this area, they turn the cameras on them, and they start saying, no, don't film us on the camera. You watch this. This is very interesting.
Amigos, what country?
No.
What country?
No.
Why? What country?
No.
You from Syria?
No. I'm so ridiculous, man.
Syria.
What country are you guys from? Hey, well, why is it a big secret? What's the problem?
No.
Why not?
You're from Syria?
Whoa, what's the problem?
No. You so got tell from Syria? Why are these guys, these guys are getting ready to sneak into our country. Why are they being so evasive and covering their face? Why? And these are not women and children either, people. Look at these men.
You guys okay?
No women, no children. No, there's women and children here. So this is the staging area. Then when they come out of the Darien Gap, this is the NGOs that are look at all this food that they have set up for them, where they give them food. They're facilitating the entire trip. This is why the migrants are coming, because it's being facilitated by these NGOs that the Biden administration and the Democrats are funding. They want to fund them more, these NGOs. Take a list. This is crazy.
Given the aid and instructions necessary to continue their journey to the United States. So-called migration route maps can be found everywhere. The
Red
same
Cross.
UN-affiliated organizations seen earlier along the
UNICEF.
Route also have a presence inside these Panamanian camps. A few on the scene.
So this group right here, let's go back. We all know UNICEF.
Also have a presence in
this group right here. This is the United Nations Office of Immigration or something like that, NGO. So this is the UN here. You saw UNICEF and the Red Cross.
A few on the scene include OIM, Red Cross, UNICEF, HIAS, European.
Now, this one really just blew me away, that the European Union is one of the NGOs in Central America facilitating the invasion of our country. What the European Union? What the hell is the European Union doing in Central America facilitating these migrants? This is in Panama. This is where these guys are. The European Union is there facilitating these migrants. And this is in Spanish. Oh, man, this is hilarious. Oh my God, they know what's going on. This is so I'll tell you what the theory is, that several people have, and this gets back to what we're talking about the dumbing down of the country and everything that these people, if you'll see, we'll talk about here in a moment.
European Union, Doctors Without Borders, UNHCR, and the Norwegian Refugee Council. From these camps, illegals are put onto buses and shuttled northward to Costa Rica. From here, illegals ride buses across Nicaragua, Honduras, and Guatemala until they reach the border of Mexico. We travel to the Guatemalan border town of Tecunuman, where human smugglers, most likely affiliated with the Sinaloa cartel, charged us $125 each to be smuggled into Mexico.
So the cartels are making tons of money. The cartels are thriving off of this. The NGOs know that too. The NGOs that are facilitating them from coming up through Panama, and they're there with the food and the supplies and the maps telling them where to go. They know that when they go to Mexico, those same NGOs, UNICEF, the Red Cross knows that when those women that they give maps in Panama, they know when they get to go to Mexico that they're going to be robbed and raped. They know that. The Biden administration knows that. The Democrats that want to fund those NGOs more know that, and they're facilitating it. It's pretty disgusting. It's pretty disgusting. So that just really just scratches the surface a little bit. I don't want to go into this more because I don't have a lot more time, but on Friday, we're going to get into this Senate bill that they're looking to pass this week. And we're going to get more into what's actually going on with this immigration. I want to show you a little bit about the Chinese part in this documentary before we go, where they talk about the Chinese. Take a listen.
So right now we are in Colombia at the Cabañas Rio Mayo Hotel. And this hotel that we stumbled upon by accident is a major hub, a major transit point, meeting place for Chinese foreign nationals that are on their way to the United States. And last night when we were here, we were eating at this hotel restaurant, and we were the only foreigners that were not Chinese. I mean, literally the entire hotel is just Chinese foreigners. We spoke with the hotel staff here, and they confirmed that. And while there are some women and children, it's mostly military-aged males. There's some right behind me right now, actually.
All right.
One thing to note is that among all of the foreign nationals that are entering the United States illegally, the Chinese are among the most well-funded and the most sophisticated in the way they go about getting to the United States. Whereas the Venezuelans, for example, are very poor. They just trek up to the United States on foot in mass caravans. They don't have much money. The Chinese are very well-funded. They're the ones that are taking planes. We're right across the street from an airport right now. And they also have established networks. And this hotel that we're at is proof of that. It's all Chinese, and for some reason they all know to come here. It's because they are in direct communication. People that are further up the trail or that have made it to the United States are telling people that are on their way, hey, this is a hotel that's safe for you. We also found we are staying at this hotel, you know, they're expecting Chinese. You can see a lot of the writings, a lot of the signs in this hotel are written in Chinese. Again, this is further proof that it's not by accident. It's not just some sort of one-off occasion that there's all of these Chinese nationals here at this point.
Yeah, it's not by accident. None of this is by accident at all. And, I mean, it's really frightening what's going on, actually. If you think about some of these theories that are coming out, because I've heard people saying, even Brett Weinstein in his interview with Tucker Carlson, and Tucker agreed with him that that the Biden administration and Democrats are going to be offering these people citizenship for service in the military. That so they want to go out and they want to fight all these wars. They're kicking off more wars in the Middle East again. You know, they're saying that Chuck Schumer came out and says that if we don't pass this bill, which in this immigration bill is $60 billion for Ukraine, $20 billion to secure our borders, $60 billion to Ukraine, $14 to Israel. So they're kicking off the wars. Americans don't want to go fight these wars. Americans don't want to enlist in the military anymore. Their recruitment is down significantly. So a lot of people have theorized that they're going to be offering these immigrants citizenship to enlist in the military to go fight these foreign wars. And a lot of these immigrants don't have a connection to the American people. And if they're told to turn their guns on the American people, they will be more more willing to do so than American citizens in the military, are some theories, which are really, really frightening when you see the numbers of these people that are coming over, and they're already offering them citizenship for service in the military. So that's what's going on. Again, we'll talk more about it on Friday, and I hope you guys enjoyed it. I'll see you guys on Friday.